You are listening to Money on the Left, a monthly interdisciplinary podcast that reclaims money's public powers for imaginative, intersectional politics. Proudly presented in partnership with Monthly Review Online. What does it mean when a school of thought moves from the margins to the mainstream? This is a question that's no doubt been on this podcast listener's minds over the last several years. From the achingly near-miss candidacy of Bernie Sanders for the presidency in 2020, to the clear demonstration of government's ability to spend money into existence in the early years of the COVID-19 pandemic, to the durable and increasingly emphasized presence of the trillion-dollar platinum coin as a kind of Chekhov's gun of U.S. fiscal policymaking, it's been at times hard to call MMT a marginalized theory and keep a straight face. Though its origins were modest, the gains of MMT over the past couple of decades shouldn't be underestimated. Admittedly far more successful than MMT at moving from the margins to the mainstream has been the style of thought and analysis known as critical theory. With far grander origins than MMT in the halls of premier and Ivy League institutions, critical theory as we know it has, for much of its existence, nevertheless acted and functioned more as an obscure avant-garde than as a reigning intellectual orthodoxy. Now that, as Michael W. Kloon puts it in his review of this month's guest book, quote, "This style of thought and vocabulary," meaning critical theory, "has been lifted from the box of the English department and placed in the infinitely better furnished and more spacious boxes of some society's most powerful institutions," the question arises, what can an English professor teach someone about race, class, gender, or capitalism that they can't learn on the internet or Netflix? End quote. To help answer that question, as well as to ponder the paradox of the humanities' new heterodoxies, we were thrilled this month to be joined by Elizabeth Anker, Associate Professor of English at Cornell University and Professor of Law in the Cornell Law School. Through our conversation, we learn about and expand upon the arguments of her provocative book, which is called On Paradox, The Claims of Theory, and which came out last year with Duke University Press. Sharing strong parallels with our own project at Money on the Left, Anker urges leading thinkers in the emergent orthodoxy of critical theory to build out a new, affirmative, and integrative criticism, better suited to carefully and constructively addressing today's most grave and immediate threats. Thank you to Liz for joining us. Thanks to Emily Amber Reynolds for the graphic, to Mike Lewis for the transcripts, and to Nani Kula for the theme tune. Please support this project by joining our Patreon, which is linked to in the show notes. Elizabeth Anker, welcome to Money on the Left.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here. Wonderful to meet you guys.
It's great to meet you too. We were just talking about coming into contact with your book and some of the reasons that we're excited about it. And that book is On Paradox, The Claims of Theory, out with Duke University Press in 2022. Before we get into, and I think to help us contextualize our discussion, could you share a little bit about your personal and professional background and kind of the academic fields and concerns that have driven your scholarship and your teaching too, up to the point of the publication of On Paradox?
Yeah, absolutely. I have an unusual background in that I have both a JD and a PhD in literary studies, and a joint appointment between the law school at Cornell and the English department. So I've spent lots of time thinking about both the stakes of interdisciplinarity and some of the challenges of doing interdisciplinary work and kind of speaking across audiences. So I'm incredibly sensitive to the difficulty of certain humanities fields that they experience in addressing wider audiences. But in a way, this book really stemmed from two different projects that I spent a lot of time working on, both of which were edited collections. The first was a big edited collection on law and literature, which is actually an interesting field because it was one of the first kind of interdisciplinary junctures, so to speak. So scholars already back in the early 80s were bringing literature to bear to think about legal questions and vice versa. So a few years ago, I edited in this collection with my friend and colleague at Stanford Law School, Bernie Myler. And in the process of doing that, we really tried to make sense out of the dominant shape and orientation of scholarship that thinks about law and literature together. And in that effort to kind of taxonomize and dissect these main approaches to that particular interdisciplinary field, we kind of seized on a series of problems, and there's a way in which those problems also inform some of the arguments that I make in this book. For instance, literature scholars tend to almost scapegoat law precisely so that they can make the argument that literature comes along to save the day. So a lot of humanistic work on legal questions turns law, you know, just big monolithic thing into almost a kind of straw man that's really easy to be torn down, but through a series of super reductive critiques that actually end up falsifying legal process and its real world operations in certain ways. So one of the arguments on Paradox has to do with this ongoing tendency to explain law in ways that are just plain inaccurate and reductive and simplifying. I'm sure I'll get to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But the other big project that I spent years working on that was that very much sowed the seeds for this book was another edited collection with my former mentor, Rita Felsky, on critique and post-critique. Rita's written a lot about the limits of critique, and in a way that's a big project trying to weigh in on what people refer to as the method wars within theory. So this book on Paradox is kind of my own foray into the method wars to account for, you know, where theory has gone wrong, so to speak, and for the ways in which it needs to reinvent itself. So just to sum up, a lot of the book stems from the fact that I'm somebody who has one foot in law and one foot in literary studies, and have therefore been able to assume something of an outsider's vantage point, asking about the crisis in the humanities and these larger trends that are overtaking humanistic inquiry. But with all of that in mind, there's a way in which the book is also kind of my take on the crisis in the humanities. People have probably seen the recent article about the death of the English major and these outcries about the end of the liberal arts or the corporatization of the university have been on everybody's mind of late. And in a way, the book is also its own account of where that crisis came from. That's in part an account taken from an outsider's viewpoint. And there's a way in which I take an unpopular view, which is that humanists are in part responsible for their own growing obsolescence. Obviously, there are all sorts of other big factors tied to neoliberalism and so on, but some of that responsibility that humanists carry themselves has to do with what I call paradox, or this idea that some of their primary methodological approaches have either backfired or gone astray or simply haven't delivered on their promise. So there is a way in which the book is a plea for humanists' own self-reckoning.
Thanks for that. So maybe we can focus a little bit more about the specific origins of On Paradox. It's a pretty wide-ranging book in terms of the topics and the issues that it covers. So what are the origins of this specific project? What questions did it emerge from? Did its arguments spring from a core inquiry or focus? We know from communicating with you that you were going to write a modest, small book about one little thing, and then it kind of blossomed into what it's become.
Yeah, the book initially was going to be a mere fraction of its current length and scope. And it was initially an attempt to wrestle with what people have referred to as the human rights turn in the humanities. About 10 to 15 years ago, a whole series of humanistic fields, history, anthropology, you know, even gender studies, literary studies, were all abuzz with excitement, talking about human rights and what rights were, their limits and their promise. And I decided I was going to write a short book that attempted to make sense out of that growing preoccupation, given the skepticism about law that prevails within a lot of these fields. To me, it seemed perplexing that suddenly a bunch of literary critics thought human rights were so important and were kind of rah-rah jumping on the human rights bandwagon. So in the process of accumulating, trying to digest, trying to make sense out of what on earth people thought they were talking about when they started talking about human rights, I was struck by a series of things. The big thing being almost everybody either began or concluded by observing just how paradoxical rights were. So as a diagnosis of rights, paradox was held out and arrived at by almost everybody. And often people did so in a way that also presented paradox as some kind of epiphanic recognition. So I was struck by the just kind of rote predictability of paradox as a way of talking about rights discourse and human rights. And in a way, that's absolutely true. There's no question that rights have proven deeply paradoxical. They've been kind of impaled by their paradoxes again and again, whether in practice or as a philosophical construct or even as a discourse. Rights are deeply contradictory. There's no question about that. But I was nevertheless troubled by the uniformity of the ways that theorists were talking about rights. And in the process, I was also struck by the fact that paradox tended to stand in for deeply polar things. On the one hand, paradox was a way of talking about the fatalities of rights, the failures, the limits, the disappointments, the spent promise, so everything wrong with rights. It was almost a way of critiquing rights by saying, oh, they're too paradoxical to be valuable. But at the same time, all sorts of other theorists and literary critics were citing to paradox as the very locus of rights' ongoing promise. The fact that rights were paradoxical was what made them fertile, fecund, open-ended, this valuable source of justice for the future. So I was trying to make sense out of the fact that paradox meant two totally different things, and it often would even do so in the same study. Somebody would blame rights for being woefully paradoxical and therefore complicit with power, but then say, well, their paradoxes is also what make them democratic and ethical and just. So I was initially trying to wrestle with all of this and suddenly realized that this framework, these tendencies for making sense out of rights were showing up in all sorts of other areas. Debates about democracy, debates about the humanities, debates about modernity. And so I came to recognize that I was really attempting to map and contend with a whole kind of worldview or mentality or even epistemology or way of knowing, we could say, that really has been definitive of theory. So I felt the need to really broaden the focus of this initially narrow study on rights to make sense out of and grapple with kind of what the genetics of theory, so to speak, or some of the dominant assumptions that inform critical theory as this really far-reaching intellectual formation and intellectual tradition. So it became, as one of my friends would tell me, a book about everything.
It really is a book about everything. And it got me thinking a lot about my own kind of the evolution of my relationship with critical theory from, you know, the experience of graduate school and the sort of initial excitement of encounters with paradox, and then the eventual kind of malaise, melancholy, and inertia that comes from paradox, ultimately realizing while on the job market and then in my first job that humanities scholars have been talking about these things for a long time, and our work conditions, our workplaces have not gotten the same kind of critical attention or critical self-reflection, and that the paradox of that is very difficult to live with. And so I think part of what we're up to here at Money on the Left and our collective more broadly is the kind of constructive, let's build something, right? In place of this void of paradox, let's improve our workplaces, right? Like, let's take that inventory and get to the business of making a better world.
That comment very much captured the sort of trajectory or history of this style of thought or sort of intellectual mindset that I'm trying to track and make sense out of, which is that you're absolutely right that paradoxes are thrilling, and a particular style of thought grounded in reasoning through paradox or the discovery of these, again, revelatory, eye-opening capacities of paradox was this exhilarating, new, highly creative thing when theory came of age in the academy, right? So with the advent of theory 50 years ago, or what have you, 40, 50 years ago, paradox was new. But over the last 40 years, it's become routinized. So this particular style of thought that once carried all this promise has become too predictable, too much of what we do, and really fails to speak to our kind of lived conditions and ongoing, most urgent political realities. So some of the book's arguments are, first, that this style of thought needs to be updated. It's become passé, right? Ideas that made sense 40 years ago don't necessarily make sense in the present. And one of the big reasons, secondly, that it needs updating is that it's failed to translate into what we could call a practice, or an applied theory, or a set of tools for building better worlds. And I think one of my arguments is that it's not only that it's failed to translate, that this style of thought that I call paradox can actually short circuit or impede forms of real world action because of the various sort of hangups that come with it.
Well, when you start to encounter like administration within the context of the university, you start to wonder to what extent that paradox, that style of thought, actually serves the system as it exists, the de facto administrative apparatus. And of course, folks who end up in administration have been around for a long time, and they were in those theory wars at the beginning, or the theory development at the beginning.
But yeah, we tend to, just to piggyback on that, we theorists, right, have tended to presume that this method of reasoning that, again, I call paradox, equals a particular politics, that to be attuned to paradox is to be a good lefty, to be a good radical, to be social justice oriented. And that's just not the case. This style of thought is highly susceptible to being co-opted or hijacked. And in fact, I really think that's what we're witnessing at this moment in history. Whether by administrators who might not actually have the best interests of English departments or other humanities fields in mind, or frankly, by really powerful political actors who are kind of ruining democracy right now. I'll hopefully get to talk a little bit about my next project at some point, but the thing I'm working on right now is precisely to try to track how this style of thought is being actively misappropriated to undermine and sabotage a left social justice progressive political agenda.
You can sort of see it in your teaching, and I wonder if this is something that you may have experienced too, where the same kind of surprise and delight that I got from paradox as a student, maybe it's my own failings as a teacher, but I struggle to reproduce that for students today because it feels so de rigueur and not surprising and not delightful, right? In fact, it's all over everywhere. So what does pedagogy figure into your kind of view of the situation of paradox's effects?
You know, to be totally honest, pedagogy is where it gets hardest for me. On the one hand, it is absolutely true that paradox has become second nature to, you know, our current generation of college students, kids in their 20s, right? You know, all you have to do is a quick search of Amazon for books with paradox in the title. And that language actively works to trivialize and dumb things down. And again, applies to everything from like food crises. So if anything, it's become its own sort of neoliberal mantra or self-help recipe to talk about paradox. And there's a self-indulgent wallowing in paradox, feel good, self-discovery element that gets capitalized on in a lot of, you know, bestsellers, popular culture, what have you. So students, there's nothing new about paradox to students. But it is, I find that it's tricky because I myself in the classroom sometimes do nevertheless praise the virtues of things like indeterminacy, inconclusivity, indecision, irresolution as values for awakening or eliciting a particular kind of moral and ethical engagement. So pedagogy and the experience of teaching very much helped to crystallize and motivate some of the book's arguments. But to be honest, it's also where I find myself still championing and celebrating the powers of paradox and insisting that we still need some paradox and there are still lots of things that we can learn from it. I mean, I'm by no means arguing that we need to do away with this style of thought. The book's main take is that it's simply become far too much of what we do. And if anything, the only thing that theorists have learned to do. And that's the problem with it. Not that it doesn't contain value in certain contexts, but that we've lost sight of the specificity of context and deploy this reasoning everywhere, whereas it should be confined to much narrower types of debates and inquiries.
So across your first five chapters and a brief interlude, your book traces paradox's surprisingly consistent importance and centrality for a wide range of critical disciplines, fields, discourses, and even social movements. Would you mind walking us through some of your key arguments in the specific chapters? And maybe we can start with chapter one, where you take on the grand conception of modernity as a periodizing term, and you reveal, you make the case that our very theorization and conception of modernity is to the bones thoroughly paradoxical.
Yeah, again, I mean, one of the book's goals is to really show that this reasoning shows up absolutely everywhere. Basically, any issue that has been deemed worthy of serious intellectual attention or theorization ends up being found to be paradoxical. And one of the prime sites where that occurs, and I would wager even one of the earliest sites where that occurs, if you think about intellectual history, is debates about modernity. And if you do one of those Google n-grams, it's even right when people started using the language of modernity, late 18th century, you see a spike in the use of the term paradox. And once again, that diagnosis makes total sense. Of course, to be modern is to be steeped in paradox. Basically, everything about modern life, selfhood, individuality, right, politics, you name it, is no doubt paradoxical. But one of the things I try to trace in that chapter is, again, the routinization of that diagnosis and how it came to be a kind of intellectual second nature, so that it became impossible to talk about something like modernity without citing to its paradoxes. But I kind of use modernity and debates about modernity in that chapter as an example also to show the very ambidextrous and multifaceted intellectual labor that citation to paradox carries out. And this is true within most theory that performs a particular kind of reasoning. So paradox basically oversees all stages and all aspects of the reasoning process. So for instance, it's a diagnosis, right? Modernity is paradoxical. Of course it is. But that diagnosis usually embeds a critique of certain aspects of modernity. We can think about, you know, classic Marxist critiques of capitalism as a distinctly modern bequest, right? Capitalism is obviously a bad thing, but it's by way of citing to or excavating its many paradoxes and contradictions that it's revealed to be so lethal and predatory and all of those things. So paradox is a diagnosis, it's a critique. It comes to basically oversee method or become the kind of backbone of method. Again, it's almost impossible to find theory that doesn't operate or proceed by way of the identification and sort of mining of a successive paradoxes. So it becomes hardwired into method. One of the things I try to wrestle with in the book is how this diagnosis of paradox, which most immediately encodes all of the bad things and liabilities of something like modernity, with the emergence and arrival of post-structuralism and all of the intellectual ferment that happens in the 1980s and 1990s, with the rise of identity politics, the revolution in the humanities, et cetera, also leads to a change in the way people started thinking and talking about paradox, so that this very notion or quality that sums up all of the perils of something like modernity simultaneously comes to be redemptive or salvific, much in the way I was talking about with rights. So the fact that modernity is paradoxical also comes to be something to be celebrated as the source of modernity's untapped promise. And I develop an account for, you know, the confluence of factors and intellectual developments that allow this diagnosis of paradox to suddenly also become a salvific one. But what happens is that paradox also emerges as a kind of destination or cure or remedy or antidote to all of these liabilities. And that's in part because paradox does something else too, and that is that it becomes deeply autobiographical for theory. It becomes its own kind of self-referential way of talking about what it means to be an intellectual, to inhabit paradox. And paradox almost comes to be transposed onto the persona or character of the great thinker, or the harbinger of modernity, or the great intellectual stage. And there too, you know, everybody from, you know, Max Weber to you name it, right? These great thinkers are almost always deemed embodiments of paradox. And what makes them great is because that their own personas metabolize all of these different paradoxes. So it also becomes, again, deeply autobiographical, or about the identity of what it means to do theory. And just really quickly, we can see how that would play out, even in terms of the way people have defined theory over the years. To be paradoxa is to be contrary to orthodoxy, to be a dissident, to be a gladfly, to be anti-authoritarian, all of those things. And so it makes complete sense that we as theorists would cathect onto that logic of paradox, or see within it mirrors of our own understanding of our job as leftist, kind of critically minded intellectuals, right? Paradoxes are also deeply anti-normative. So we can see, just thinking about the sheer like etymology of the word paradox, why it would be part of the genetics of theory.
Exactly like a cherry blossom swaying in the wind with the sunbeam in it. I think I might just be that sunbeam shining through your leaves, feeling mostly complete. You look exactly like a cherry blossom. Life is full of paradoxes. What do you mean? 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 What do you mean?
Could you talk a little bit more about the Cold War context in which you trace the rise of post-structuralism, especially in the States, and why paradox becomes newly enticing given that context?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, my argument about what happens in the 70s is that there are a whole series of intellectual development and a particular historical milieu that come together in ways that really kind of, you know, reinforce paradox as a way of knowing or an epistemology, but all provide separate kind of intellectual warrants for intellectual reasons that paradox becomes so incredibly powerful as an explanatory framework. One of those is absolutely the Cold War context. And a particular definition or account of totalitarianism that begins to take hold and that everybody agrees on. And totalitarianism is increasingly defined as a political system that is hostile to pluralism, plurivocality, paradox. And so totalitarianism is understood as this sort of unifying force that's going to, by definition, devour multiplicity and paradox and dissent and all of that. And so democracy and everything anti-totalitarian is increasingly explained in terms of its paradoxes. And this sort of thinking is, I think, generally in the air at that moment in history. The kind of anti-totalitarianism of paradox would also explain why deconstruction would be one of the most influential progenitors of this kind of reasoning, perhaps within the academy. So there's something about that Cold War environment and a celebration of speech for speech's sake that lends this logic of paradox incredible currency. That Cold War environment, one of my arguments, also colludes with these lingering residues of the 1960s and 68, which also endowed the dissidence of paradox and the anti-authoritarianism of paradox with a particular kind of purchase. We can think about the sort of magical psychedelic thinking of 68 as its own, appetite for paradox and for those mind-altering discoveries that we can associate with that thinking. But a series of other things come along, in sort of intellectual developments within the academy. Perhaps the biggest is the linguistic turn and the rise of post-Saussurean theories of language and representation provide a separate warrant for why paradox is so powerful and all meaning is going to stem from or inhere within paradox. I also talk about the rise of literary study, right? The 80s are sort of the heyday of aesthetic theory. I talk a little bit about how these thinkers are also drawing from theology, but the point is that all of these things kind of come together in the perfect intellectual storm that all separately reinforce and incite this sense that to be paradoxical is to be, alive and energetic and attuned as a thinker.
Would you mind discussing one particular example of one of the paradoxes, supposed paradoxes of modernity, whether it's in reference to Baudelaire or any other of the thinkers that you cite?
I guess I would come back to, something like democracy, because, and I'll use that as an example, simply because I think this mode of thought, this modality, is particularly rampant still today within a lot of political theory and especially radical democratic theory. We can see why democracy would be paradoxical, right? It's a perennially failed project. Democracy depends on this artificial construction of the people, but we know that nation states are woefully exclusionary and are never going to have perfect representation. So the, paradoxes that extend from modern practices of democracy are countless, right? And incurable in many respects. So again, no doubt that democracy as an institution is fatally flawed, and fatally flawed because of these paradoxes of incomplete representation. But what occurs in a lot of political theory is that very incompleteness comes to be celebrated because it's seen as paradoxical. So the fact that the people is forever incomplete gets read as a positive thing. And the source of the very fluidity and indeterminacy and open-endedness of that category of the people. If the people was closed, right? Then it wouldn't be paradoxical. So there's a sort of embrace of the very properties that one might, and simultaneously in the same breath, is despairing of. So one of my arguments about what this logic of paradox that again starts to take hold in the 1980s does is that it performs a kind of alchemy or almost a transient substantiation. There's almost kind of something theological about it, where it works to redeem a legitimacy deficit or justificatory deficit, right? The fact that the people is fatally flawed, going back to Rousseau, right, is clearly a problem for the legitimacy of democracy, right? Democracy, one of the reasons democracy is paradoxical is because it confronts this irresolvable legitimacy crisis, right? And deficit of legitimacy. But by describing that legitimacy deficit as paradoxical, that very failure comes to be rescued and lo and behold, fully celebrated or extolled as the very wellspring of democracy's promise. And this is a move that comes very, very clearly from the long history of aesthetic criticism and theology, right? Let's think about, like, you know, theodicy and attempts to reckon with, right, the limits of a deity, right? We've all had to study this stuff once upon a time, right? The fact that God is, right, you know, omnipresent and omniscient, yet nevertheless allows evil in the world, right? That's a paradox. But that unknowability of God and unfathomability of God within theology comes to be embraced and exalted as the very essence of what makes God God, right? So again, this logic of paradox performs a kind of conversion that takes what looks at first blush like a liability into the very locus of the just and ethical promise of something, whether it's God or the humanities.
I'd like to try to paraphrase some of the argumentation you've been working through in order to tease out some of the resonances that I'm hearing, which is part of the problem with this mode of paradoxical thinking that, you know, maybe there's other paradoxical modes of thinking, but this particular mode that's so widespread that you're tracing, part of its major problem is that it weirdly, in wanting to unsettle, you know, the master signifier, the law of the father, you know, in order to unsettle these dominant hegemonic terms, the people, democracy, right? It has to perform the failure of its univocity, the failure of its single or array of clustered singular meanings, and say, no, it actually does the opposite. You think it does inclusion? It does exclusion. You think it does, you know, bringing people together? No, it brings people apart, right? And I think one of the ways in which what you're up to resonates with what we're up to, I think, is there, you don't have to take those hegemonic understandings for granted. You don't have to give away the game to a particular Enlightenment understanding of the people. For us especially, you don't have to take the liberal understanding of money and its ontology and its topology. You don't have to take it for granted and just do immanent critique and show how it's internally contradictory. You can say, well, wait a minute, what if you start from different premises? What if you don't start from the premise of that money is a private barter relationship of that ends up in this massive system of mutual exploitation? What if you start with it as a public utility or a legal design question? What opens up instead? So to me, what's so illuminating about your book is it gives us this language and so many historical analyses of this problem of giving over to the master term that you're supposedly trying to undermine.
Yeah, I love that point. And I have to confess that I haven't thought about one of the things I'm after along those lines. And that's why I love it so much. But I think you're absolutely right that some of the problems with this style of thought is that it ends up reinforcing the authority of the very thing ostensibly being critiqued, right? So it ends up almost like reifying or ceding the game to the explanatory power of, right, liberal accounts of capitalism, right, or liberal accounts of rights, because it's so dependent on that again, almost kind of reductive notion of what's being critiqued. I think you're absolutely right. And for me, another extension of that is that it can contribute to this kind of romance of failure and romance of impossibility, because part of the logic of paradox, right, is to be adamantly resistant to ever lodging itself or installing itself as a new dominant, right, or a new normativity. So the moment you win, right, you know, you have to immediately undercut what you just won. So they're almost like tripwires installed in this logic, right? The moment what's excluded comes to be included, oh, that very thing becomes bad, right? Because it's the new dominant. But that becomes an endless game that leads us nowhere. I love that way of framing it. Yes, another paradox, yeah.
Is there something about paradox inherently that we could say is atomizing or alienating and maybe effectively discouraging? It's exciting, but there's a sort of flat affect afterwards where there needs to be a kind of supplement, and that might be what you're after or suggesting here.
Yeah. And again, I'm perhaps most critical of the modes of thought that we can associate with post-structuralism and that took hold in the 80s. You know, first, I very much agree that there's nothing about this reasoning on its own that's inherently problematic. The idea is that this logic that's been so dominant, and if anything, the exclusive way people think in certain fields really needs to be supplemented or complemented with other styles of thought. We've been doing half of what we need to do, and we need to do the other half. But just kind of as one further example of where this perhaps comes from to sort of explain how it takes hold and why it has placed a stranglehold on more affirmative, constructive modes of thought. Again, I think so much of this style of thought can actually be attributed to post-Husserlian linguistics and the theories of meaning that emerge. If we think about Jacques Derrida and his account of a text, right, or writing, meaning inheres with the slippages, the deferrals, the gaps between words, the impossibilities of clear presence, the fact that you're never going to have transparent understanding. It's always going to be somehow, meaning is going to kind of emerge through those impossibilities, through those delays, through those foreclosures and limits to what we can know. Right, meaning, action, agency, everything has been imagined to inhere within those kind of slippages and deferrals. And I think what's taken hold within a lot of theory is anytime there's an effort to account for meaning or agency or action that's not displaced, right, along such lines, it's dismissed as simply wrong, or selling out, or liberal, or again, or just plain mistaken. And one of the challenges in writing the book is has been recognizing just how thoroughgoing this mode of thought is, while really trying to push back against the tradition that's hardwired to dismiss an effort to be affirmative, concrete, constructive, et cetera, as point blank mistaken, right? Or point blank wrong or missing the picture.
So this is a great pivot, I think, to our question about your second and third chapters. And that's where you uncover what you reveal to be this deep anti-legalism that subtends, paradoxically, both a positive discourse of rights, but also the critique of rights. So we've been kind of referring to it, but can you delve into this problem and how are dismissals and recuperations of rights both rooted in paradox? And then what for you does this have to do with aesthetic theory?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big question. One of the things I try to do throughout the book is to think about how reasoning that lends precedence to paradox can lead to polar impulses. And one of them that I think we were kind of touching on, or you brought up when you talked about how this logic can end up reinforcing the power of the very thing being critiqued, is that when something like capitalism, and this is where I, would have a fight to pick with at least some Marxist theory, capitalism, for instance, is seen as fundamentally contradictory in ways that basically ontologize or reify that property. Paradox is something that my brain is a quality in my head that I'm reading onto something to help me make sense out of it. It is not a material property of reality. I would dispute that it is. But when it is deemed thus, right, or fatally part of something's architecture or gene pool, that ends up rendering paradox a foregone conclusion. And I worry about that tendency in terms of how it can tie our hands in resisting a given structure or cause the problem to seem so fatally incurable that it can lead to forms of defeatism and inertia in the face of this, structure that's deemed paradoxical. I think that plays out with particular vividness in the skepticism about law that has prevailed within basically across the humanities and even within a lot of critical legal studies circles. My favorite example, Wendy Brown and Janet Halley have a edited collection called Left Legalism, Left Critique. And their introduction basically says, submitting any otherwise principally minded left project to the law is going to contaminate it in certain ways. So making recourse to the legal system is going to, by definition, dilute a particular left progressive justice oriented agenda going to involve inevitably a form of self-betrayal. And I think that's just wrong. But that mindset that law is fundamentally bankrupt prevents all sorts of political action that might be really, really successful. I think that mindset is incredibly widespread and really gets us in trouble as theorists because it rationalizes and can lead to an excuse for forms of opting out or not trying in the first place. And that suspicion of law is so pervasive in a lot of theory. The other example I like to bring to mind is a text like Judith Butler's Gender Trouble, probably one of the most influential theoretical texts, and rightly so, right? It revolutionized our ways of talking about gender and ways that have trickled down into the popular consciousness, right? Amazingly important and successful text. Nevertheless, within this otherwise fantastic book, the rhetoric of the juridical circulates throughout in ways that basically are shorthand for power and oppression. So describe something as juridical is basically to mean that it's oppressive. And again, that just erases and obscures and is just plain wrong about all of these really important social, political advances that over the centuries the law has facilitated. So this kind of suspicion of law is really problematic in terms of how it can basically sanction an action and discourage an action. Like I'm sure some of my humanities colleagues kind of look down their noses at me even having a joint appointment in the law school as its own form of selling out. So I'm really trying to push back against that legal skepticism as one of the reasons that so much theory has really failed to actualize itself in a viable practice, or why so many humanities fields have kind of remained cloistered and refused to get their hands dirty by actually tangling with real world forms of action.
And then what about the school that embraces rights as a framework and yet on your reading always predicated on the anti-legalistic failure arguments that the straight up anti-law scholars embraced?
The kind of school of post-structuralism deconstruction, somebody like Jacques Rancière, right, is this very hot figure these days, I think subscribes to its own kind of anti-legalism or legal skepticism, but it plays out in a somewhat different way there, in that justice is seen as fundamentally uncodifiable. So the minute you can actually codify or consecrate something in a legal decision or law code, that is seen to be the betrayal of these otherwise just ideas. And again, this comes directly from a particular theological tradition that is antinomian. So an antinomianism is perhaps the better way to describe that impulse.
Can you describe what that means for you?
Antinomianism simply means that it's tied in more Protestant traditions to a conception of grace that is very individualistic. It basically means that law in the books is going to be fundamentally incomplete and flawed. So it's almost more of a Pauline conception of divine inspiration.
I think the term that we often use at Money on the Left is anti-medial or anti-mediation, right? There's a sense that mediation is necessarily extrinsic and imposed. Yeah. And it's something that, we may be all fallen into in a biblical and Lacanian sense or a Heideggerian sense. We're all fallen into it, but it is still nevertheless an imposition that we sort of wish that we could be outside of.
Yeah.
And we try to conceive of and imagine a just world with that critical leverage of not being fallen into language or not be fallen into the juridical. So that's how we make sense of it.
Yeah. And I mean, kind of thinking about the antinomian a bit further, I mean, the big, prophet of paradox that, again, everybody was reading in the 80s is Soren Kierkegaard, right? Fear and Trembling, this meditation on, Abraham's willingness to sacrifice Isaac. And the language of paradox is everywhere in a text like that. And it's the incommunicability, the untranslatability, the fact that nobody would understand that willingness, that it would seem mad and frankly evil to everybody except Abraham, right? Is its own version of antinomianism. But Kierkegaard also was a, you know, big conduit for the thrill of paradox, right? I mean, you probably remember reading Kierkegaard for the first time. And I've had people over the years, when I tell them about the book, say, oh, that sounds like the first time I read Kierkegaard, you know, so...
Abraham, worth the righteous one, take upon the wood, put it on your son. Lake or lamb, there is none to harm. When the angel came, you had raised your arm.
Mentioned a couple times the phrase selling out, which resonated with me for a couple reasons. One, we're talking about actually Scott's book in class yesterday, Money, Culture, Media with Students. We were talking about critical theory. So it's very pertinent to what we're talking about now. And the concept of, through discussion, how selling out was more of a concern, it seems like, in the heyday, I'm making this connection myself, in the heyday of the logic of paradox, like its sort of early rise. And I think today there's a romance of selling out now, as opposed to, so it's the rise and grind, there's the culture of hustle as a kind of, yeah, a completion of that rejection of selling out as an abject thing that you don't want to do as a participant in the economy. And it's part of this idea of, yeah, money's bad, whereas now it's like, yeah, no, you got to get your hustle on, you got to get your stuff. And selling out is probably a good thing, so you probably have some colleagues who are like, get the bag, do your thing. Scott, I know that you wanted to get us into the aesthetic question.
Right. Well, in your interlude, Liz, you roped this anti-legalism, I think, into an argument about a kind of a conception about the aesthetic as an intellectual project, as a institutional project.
Yeah. I think one of the big sources of this style of reasoning is kind of aesthetic theory, or, you know, literary and poetic criticism, frankly, going all the way back to Plato. There are brief interludes in this long history of literary criticism where people are doing something different, like in the, you know, 18th century for a couple decades. But there's been a remarkable centrality attributed to paradox when talking about the power of art. We'll, I think, be able to see the symmetries or parallels between what that work does in theology. But I mean, a lot of these early theorists were also doing literary studies, and as theory kind of migrated through the Anglo-American university, it stopped first in English departments, right? So the English departments were the big proponents of it. So I think it picked up a lot of these tendencies there. But already the early moderns, Renaissance thinkers, were obsessed with a paradox that you get from Plato, which was referred to as the liar's paradox. So, you know, and everybody loves this paradox, right? If I say, I'm about to lie to you, it's raining outside, am I telling the truth or am I lying? It's actually like 90 in Ithaca. But, right? So, you know, if you tell someone you're telling a lie, is that telling the truth or is it lying? But that's what fictions do. That's what all of art does. All of art says, I'm a fiction. This is imaginary. And so it's a different, it's a paradoxical form of truth telling. For Plato, that was one of the reasons to expel the poets from the Republic, because they were fiction tellers. They were lie tellers. And basically, since the early modern period, someone like Sir Philip Sidney is a great example, the logic of paradox, they've recuperated that epithet and said, actually, no, what was a problem for Plato, we tell lies, is the very power of art that we tell lies. And so this kind of spirit of paradox has defined accounts of what art is and what the value of art is, you know, basically for hundreds of years. And I think that the endurance, right, and longevity of that tradition is one thing that people picked up on. And one of the reasons that this style of thought that I'm saying took hold in the 1980s was so readily internalized, because it capitalized on intellectual traditions that had been around for a very, 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 very long time. But there too, there's a particular relationship to truth telling or meaning that needs to be routed through forms of deferral, right? And delay, and that it can't be present and actualizable. It's something that can't be codified in any kind of positivistic regime. Did that speak to your question or not? Yeah, sort of.
I think that answers our questions. Probably a better segue to the selling out bad versus selling out good.
But do you mean like an embrace of the fact that everybody's complicit, and so why not just... Yeah.
There's no... Maybe the headline is, there is no ethical living under capitalism, right? As a kind of catchphrase for like millennial Gen Z online life.
So you know where I think that's showing up? And again, the stuff that I'm kind of working on as a spinoff of this project is... I don't see that kind of, you know, embrace of selling out so much in my colleagues or among my English majors. I wonder if that's kind of the mindset of the new right, or the alt-right. There's a lot being written and kind of in process on the extent to which, like, you know, the new right, NatCon, youth, are kind of embracing a certain bastardized version of Marxism. But some of the animating creeds of that kind of crowd are, I think, precisely this realpolitik, where everything is deemed coercive. There's a generalized view among the right, increasingly, that, you know, all actions are coercive, all power is dispersed. So we might as well just like engage in some power play unabashedly. And I think this reasoning is kind of in the air in some of these alt-right circles, but increasingly in institutions of power that are pretty mainstream.
I think I see it in left cultural spaces, maybe not among like left academics, maybe so much. I do think that there is a kind of like, well, what are you going to do? Give people a hard time for working and trying to make money so that they can take care of themselves. And then that being sort of like the baseline, but then we should be happy for so-and-so that they have gotten this big deal or this big outcome, and that we need to sort of like, if nothing else, that kind of like abject state of sellout is no longer a category, I feel like, so much today in the way that it was.
But I think the kind of internal, the going small is very much among the left, right? This kind of downsizing of ambitions. And your comments also making me think about Anna Kornblue's forthcoming book, and her accounts of like the rise of autofiction and first person narration, that all we can do is think about this very narrow sphere of influence, you know, everything's so sullied and suspect that we can't. So there's something deeply, kind of retreat or withdrawal that's, I think, licensed or sanctioned by this, like everybody's selling out.
I'd like to pivot to your fourth chapter, fourth and fifth. To me, in these chapters, you really drill down into very specific paradoxes or specific fields. And I think that they're the most maybe among the most likely to offend.
Yeah.
And to put it mildly,
you're the first person who's actually like said that so directly. Yeah. No. I know that.
You're welcome. You know. And I think they are another way of putting this is that because they really touch a sensitive nerve of I think what the left intelligentsia takes for granted, and it's sort of, I mean, just to start with your chapter 4 topic, the paradox of exclusion. The paradox of exclusion is that, you know, dominant forms exclude. This is bad. It's unjust. It's painful. It's harmful. There's so many things, negative things that you can communicate about exclusion. And then the response is often in this modality to give voice to the excluded, or in Adornian parlance, to give voice to suffering. And that becomes the injunction of the paradox of exclusion. And, you know, I mean, just re-articulating this paradox, it's really hard to think otherwise. It's really hard to think, wait a minute, so what are you saying? Exclusion is okay? And are you saying we shouldn't give voice to the subaltern, right? What are you saying? Right? So I want to give you a chance to kind of nuance your critique and put your most persuasive case forward.
Yeah, you know, my critiques have less to do with the power of that mode of consciousness raising, because this is really, you know, emerges with the consciousness raising campaigns of the 70s and 80s, right? With, you know, it shows up in Catherine MacKinnon's early work, trying to awaken women to their own oppression. But that logic, or that project of forever uncovering new sites of exclusion, sort of epitomizes the way in which this style of thought can backfire. On the one hand, it's limitless or insatiable. There's no end or stopping point to uncovering yet new sites of exclusion, because once something gains recognition or is included, it's no longer excluded. And so it becomes part of the problem. And in my own account, a lot of this has contributed to some of the infighting in a lot of humanities fields. A lot of humanities departments, literary studies perhaps in particular, have become really internally self-divided, even though everybody is on the same team, so to speak. And that's because we've identified with that plight of the excluded. Humanists perceive themselves as, you know, being paradoxical or contrary to doxa, themselves excluded. And so if our primary mission is to speak to terms of exclusion, there need to be exclusion somewhere. So we're going to find them, right, or create them, even if they don't really exist. So I think that this project of giving voice to exclusion has really consumed humanities fields, certain humanities fields, in ways that have become really counterproductive, and again led to forms of internal infighting and rivalries that prevent those fields from taking up other challenges, right? We only have so much energy, we can only fight so many fights, and if we're incessantly fighting with our colleagues, we're not going to take on other battles. So the kind of internal self-reference has become a real problem in certain disciplines. It's one of the reasons for the crisis in the humanities. And I try to argue that this political consciousness raising project that again has governed some of these fields has ironically led to a form of navel gazing in certain ways. I know that that's a harsh condemnation. I have kind of two other big complaints that I'll highlight for now about why this project of consciousness raising by giving voice to exclusion became self-limiting. One, the problem with this reasoning is that it gets applied to everything in a self-reproducing structure. So regardless of what's being analyzed, there's a particular methodology that gets brought to bear. And that does a couple of things. It leads to the exact same conclusions when you're applying the same methodology, regardless of your, you know, whether the object of exclusion is racial oppression or misogyny, right? You're going to reach the same conclusions. But what that does is that also works to obscure or minimize differences between different sites of exclusion. And that can lead to its own forms of inertia because, I'm sorry, to act in the real world, we need to make decisions about which problem is more grave or more severe and which is less severe. And there's a real reluctance to undertake any sort of judgment that hierarchizes in a lot of these humanities fields. I'm not saying we should do this, but I'm just using this as an example. So if I were to walk into my faculty meeting later today and say, you know, I think that abortion access issues are more important than the fight against, you know, police violence right now, and that I think that that's where I should direct my energies, you know, I would be exiled from the department within the next half hour, right? But real world political action requires that we differentiate and draw distinctions. And again, because this particular methodology of analysis has tended to operate on autopilot, it's prevented normative analysis that actually tries to differentiate between the magnitude of injuries and their severity suffered in diverse sites of exclusion, right? So in a way, you know, one of my arguments is that we haven't been critical enough, right? And that's because in critiquing everything by way of the same methodological apparatus, we actually end up preventing ourselves from making critical judgments about where to direct our limited resources. And this logic of exclusion tends to do that. The third real problem with it is just how easily it's appropriated, right? All of the men's rights stuff buys into and reproduces this exact same formula for talking about exclusion. And I've mentioned a couple of times I'm starting to work on what's going on in the U.S. Supreme Court. I have a reading of Dobbs, the decision that overruled, right, did away with the right to abortion. And I'm sorry, Samuel Alito deploys this logic of giving voice to exclusion to talk about the rights of the fetus and to start to pave a pathway for recognizing fetal personhood. And so this thinking is, again, by no means tied to a particular left progressive agenda. It's super easily plundered and misappropriated. So I'm not sure that it's the recipe for all of the good things we expect it's invariably going to be a recipe for.
So in your fifth chapter, you take up the role of paradox in what's called trauma theory. Maybe to get us into that argument, you can tell our listeners a little bit about what trauma theory is, how it arose, and yeah, how it's been on your view, overridingly positive, but that it too has limitations and blind spots that we need to be thinking about otherwise, and especially when it comes to kind of pedagogical cultures in classrooms where trauma theory is taught.
Yeah. I mean, over the course of the book, I look at a series of innovations that demand to be attributed to theory, or these, you know, this revolution in the humanities, and just how much they've really revolutionized popular discourse, right? Ideas about gender would be one, wherein, you know, theory won, right? We've changed the game. Talk of structural oppression. Even 5 years ago, discussing structural oppression would not be in common parlance, right? It's become kind of dinner table fare. My students arrive in college knowing what structural oppression is, and that's amazing. Another way in which you know, everything we've been doing in the humanities has in fact changed things. Trauma theory is another enormous site of influence. Before Vietnam, trauma was not a recognized medical diagnosis. And trauma theory arose in the academy in 70s, 80s, 90s, and gained enormous popularity. It initially thought about specifically about trauma stemming from the Holocaust, and it was heavily influenced in its earliest incarnations by both psychoanalysis, specifically psychoanalysis in the vein of Jacques Lacan, and by deconstruction. So thinkers like Jacques Derrida, Paul de Man, it's changed a lot and departed in many ways from its roots in what is often thought of as Yale School, because it happened at Yale, Yale School of Trauma Theory. But trauma theory has also been widely critiqued as kind of colonizing our available vocabularies for talking about victimization and injury. So all sorts of people have complained about, there's an influential book called The Empire of Trauma, right? Have complained about the ways trauma has become, not that trauma theory is wrong or bad on its own, but it's become our dominant and often only framework for thinking about forms of abuse, injury, victimization, and all of that. So it's the perfect example of a theoretical innovation that's reverberated throughout the real world, instituted all sorts of enormously positive change, yet nevertheless needs to be rethought precisely because it's dominated our explanatory framework so much. And so the book actually concludes by thinking about the ways it has proven limiting. And some of those limits have to do with this recurring theme is just how easy it is to be hijacked. It's easy to deploy these dominant definitions of what trauma looks like and to kind of weaponize them in ways that discredit particular injuries. I'm also concerned about the ways that it draws from an understanding of representation and linguistic meaning that can work to strangely deem trauma ethical. And so in a way, it buys into a line of thought that's really commonplace. And again, enormously productive in many instances, that asks us to think about pain and suffering as endowing the victim with privileged insight and understanding. This is the kind of reasoning that shows up in one of the most influential texts from the African-American literary canon, W.E.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk, where he coins the notion of double consciousness, which is this idea that to be the victim of protracted racial and other persecution endows one with an elevated way of knowing, or a double and multiple consciousness that allows more sophisticated grasp of not only the forces that lead to oppression, but of one's own relationship in the world. Du Bois actually calls double consciousness a paradox, believe it or not. But that thinking is super positive and super empowering. But what it does is it nevertheless takes pain and finds something redemptive within it. And again, this is valuable thinking for all sorts of reasons. But I try to reckon with the ways it's maybe gone a little bit too far. And trauma theory draws on a similar type of understanding, but supplements it with a model of the psyche that understands trauma as fundamentally elusive, repressed, fragmentary, that kind of resides within these gaps of consciousness. Right? Trauma is something we can never actually localize. All the brain does is cycle around it you know, kind of questing for its origin or cure, hence its repressed nature. But there's something about that mode of thought that can take repression and treat it as kind of restorative and even ethical. So some of this early trauma theory actively describes trauma as the kind of ethical connective tissue that will provide a link across cultures. Can see why I may be skeptical of that kind of move. So I do try to wrestle with how that kind of thinking can be problematic, among other reasons, in that it can disqualify certain kinds of injuries from counting as trauma. Lots of people have made that argument about it. Early trauma theory has been widely critiqued for being beholden to a very Eurocentric conception of the subject along these lines. But I'm interested in how, especially that model needs to be updated due to historical factors, but how that model for understanding injury can again be turned on its head or exploited and manipulated to discount historical forms of oppression, to actually undermine the victim, right, to gaslight, right, or ghost particular kinds of injuries. So trauma for me, some of these ways of talking about trauma, again, kind of epitomize the ways all of these really great innovations that come from theory can nevertheless be misappropriated and misused by hostile forces.
So I want to try to use some legalese, and you can tell me if I'm not using it correctly. But it seems to me that when trauma theory reaches its limit, it sort of at its worst, it kind of it's like turning in the realm of law. It's like turning everything into torts. It's like everything is injury, and from the point of view of what do we do going forward? How do we construct and fight for a just world? Well, let's tally up the injuries and then remedy the injuries, which we should do, but that's only one place to start. And I worry that we foreclose posing questions about the right thing to do for people, the right thing to fight for individuals, for collectives, for groups, for the globe, that aren't necessarily predicated upon intelligible injuries.
Yeah, that's one of the a critique of trauma that others have also raised that I absolutely agree with, because trauma assumes that there was some, you know, clearly isolatable injury that happened at one discrete moment in time. It actually writes off more systemic forms of injustice and injuries that can't be pinpointed in such a precise fashion. So it can actually do a real disservice to thinking about generalized conditions of harm, right, or low-grade forms of violence and injury that are woven into the day-to-day. Trauma is often thought about as exceptional. For most people, you know, a decent percentage of people in the world, right, trauma is written into their most ordinary, mundane, non-exceptional interactions and realities. And I would also say that one of the things I try to reckon with in the book is how this particular methodology of reasoning that I call this logic of paradox tends to be reproduced quite formulaically again and again and again, everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. And trauma theory exemplifies the way in which all sorts of wildly divergent and very, very different injuries, nevertheless come to be digested and deciphered by way of this recurring formal logic. So all traumas end up looking the same or being defined in the same way. And there too, it works to actually level or erase differences between different traumas that are profoundly meaningful and that I think we as theorists should be setting out to measure and to wrestle with and to document. A lot of trauma theory proceeds from the notion that there's something fundamentally unverifiable about trauma that can't be documented and that can't lend itself or that would elude legalistic regimes of evidence. And maybe, yes, that clearly is true for certain traumas, but it can actually obscure our ability to engage in forms of documentary labor or to undertake this, the kind of normative differentiation that I think the humanities have really forfeited, but that seems essential.
You have an analysis of the trauma theory classroom that I'd like to give you a chance to elaborate. The classroom in which the pedagogue is encouraging students to confess. I have to say that I don't think I've been in one of those classrooms. But I don't think I ever took a strictly trauma theory class either.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And I think this plays out within a lot of these really foundational theory texts from the 80s and 90s, where in fact, witnessing to one's own trauma is heralded as its own form of pedagogy. And so the sort of confessional mode has overtaken a lot of humanities classrooms. This was perhaps different. It's perhaps different now than it was, you know, back in the day. But I can absolutely remember classrooms wherein you authorized your own voice as a speaker by first confessing to the forms of injury that had been inflicted on you. I've even taken exams back in the day where that confessional mode was how one, I won't name any names, how one was guaranteed an A or not. But what that does is that, you know, also deauthorizes certain voices. And it, again, it risks trivializing the injuries at hand. So I do think that, right, part of the consciousness raising aspect of pedagogy has been about, you know, broadcasting one's own sites of victimization, and that kind of exercise has become compulsory in a lot of different spaces. I think the other reason we should be a little worried about that model of pedagogy that's oriented around consciousness raising in the classroom is that it presumes that symbolic change in these elite institutions of higher education is going to trickle down or translate into action on the street. And you know, I'm not so confident that symbolic awareness when one's in college is actually going to meaningfully activate an electorate. I mean, it'd be nice to think it does, but the seamlessness of that trickle-down effect, I think, has been overstated, right? Or over-wagered in a lot of humanities scholarship.
I think that there's some interesting overlap potentially between what you're kind of calling for, which seems to me like a little bit more specification about trauma, like a reconceptualizing that is about expanding and becoming more specific and not just sort of identifying all trauma as co-equal, with the history of, like, some of the histories of money that we interact with. You know, as opposed to the kind of original primordial barter situation where we're all just autonomous actors hopping around trading with each other, and then some genius person or group invents money to make it more efficient. There's an anthropological history that's much more feasible or tenable that locates it in the medieval period, Vergeld, which is trying to identify specifically, quantitatively, forms of recompense that are adequate for, you know, trauma that one inflicts on someone else. And in this case, it's like, how much is a nose worth? If you took somebody's nose off, what is that worth in terms of, you know, livestock and then, you know, gold and money and things like that? And it's a gruesome origin story, and it's not the whole story, but it's, I guess maybe I want to ask you to maybe specify or differentiate how your theory of integrative criticism, which you have identified as a kind of, toward the end of your book, in the second interlude and in the final chapter, as a potential path forward for left theory, how is it not in the field of trauma or in the logic of paradox and trauma studies? How is it different or more than, better than, different from, you know, one ear is worth 10 pieces of gold?
Yeah, a great question. I mean, I think why is an integrative approach to theorizing things different from the way trauma is often accounted for? I mean, one of the staples of a lot of especially early trauma theory is that it's resistant to healing or defiant of the cure, precisely because, right, its kernel, the traumatic kernel, is going to remain fundamentally elusive. So what that means is, if you're a trauma victim whose trauma is no longer repressed, whose trauma is self-present, who's maybe thinks that they're cured, you're not properly traumatized. And that's not really trauma that you're suffering from. So if trauma can be integrated into the psyche, it ceases to be trauma. So we can see why we have this like really narrow definition and super normative lens for dismissing or discounting certain traumas. In thinking about those types of issues, types of debate that have been left off the table or kind of prohibited by what I try to describe as an epistemology of paradox, or paradox as a way of knowing, are a lot of things that are vital ingredients of a livable and effective politics. And so by thinking about the integrative in a way that's my framework for trying to put my finger on a series of things that it's been impermissible to talk about, not to mention analyze, in a lot of critical theory or kind of lefty circles. And those are things such as when things succeed or work relatively well, right? I mean, how often have you read a book written in the humanities that takes the relative success story in the history of politics or law and says, I'm going to write a book about why this worked? Never, right? So we're just allergic to taking stock of, not to mention celebrating, our limited accomplishments. Right? Even here, I'm like mincing my words. I'm scared to say success. Right? I certainly can't say progress, right? Not to mention I would call something a victory. Ah, right? But come on. There are political accomplishments that have been successful, that have proven lasting and effective, that we should like take seriously and take stock of and ask why they worked, so that we can emulate them and replicate them. And we should also ask, right, those types of questions about, you know, forms of community, day-to-day practices that prove sustaining and effective. So when I appeal to the integrative, it's sort of a call to train our attention to all of these things that have been off the radar screen of theory and actually kind of deemed impermissible. So I think about the integrative as also a matter of when things hold together as sort of something different from the logic of paradox, right? Paradoxes work to fracture, break apart, fragment established truths, break down orthodoxies. But sometimes it's important to examine the kind of glue or connective tissue that isn't about when things fall apart, but that is what renders things sustainable, livable, habitable, again, or when things kind of come and hold together in ways that we want to applaud. So it's really a plea to turn our theoretical attention to those things that prove non-contradictory, or we might experience as non-contradictory. Not that they're going to be permanently thus, but even just episodically so.
One of the things I really appreciate, the style of your theorizing, that the stylistic turn that your theorizing takes in the late interlude in the last chapter, is you really stage for us. I mean, not in like a woe is me, but I think as an important intellectual project, how difficult and challenging this has been and has been for you and has been as part of your pedagogy, and how do I get out of those rote forms of the paradoxical with students, and what do they think, and what am I even saying, and what language am I going to use, and what kind of stylization or aesthetics are going to matter for this one potential of many alternatives to the paradoxical. So I just want to say I really appreciate that bringing us into the problem. That's a stylistic choice that you make. And I was wondering if, you know, you can speak to that, but also tell us a little bit about Virginia Woolf and A Room of One's Own, which is a bit of a touchstone in the Money on the Left community, just because precisely I think we're picking up on similar things. She's making normative demands, you know, A Room of One's Own and this much money. You know, you want to solve the women in fiction problem, people will start paying women to and furnishing their lives to be able to write fiction. So your response.
Yeah, no, thank you. And thank you for saying nice things. I mean, this last chapter of my book where I sort of, you know, I put forward a kind of alternative or right supplement to Paradox, single-handedly the hardest thing I have ever written or will ever try to write. I can't tell you how many different iterations of that I went through. Initially, I had settled on the rhetoric of the prescriptive, or the need to be prescriptive, kind of getting at normativity without, you know, fully going normative, you know, a tentative way. So to me, that was really a lesson in just how stifling this kind of intellectual tradition had become, and also just how hard it was to escape, again, what increasingly felt like a stranglehold or its own sort of, you know, internal policing mechanism. So to me, it was just an unbelievably both fascinating and kind of arduous and painful experiment to try to think differently. I do feel like it's like I put forward the integrative as one way to thinking about a supplement to Paradox. I do want to emphasize that I'm not saying it's the only way or the right way. It was the best I could come up with. But to me, what matters most is that we do something different. And that we, you know, we kind of add something to the mix, and that we don't walk away from every conversation throwing our hands up in the air and citing Paradox, right? So for me, what matters most is that we try to undertake some much more constructive, affirmative, and practically oriented, as you were saying, labor. I think there's a way in which theory has lost sight of, right, all of these aspects of lived experience and the very pragmatic, practical realities of day-to-day decisions about how we guide our lives, necessary decisions that factor into any political decision-making process, right, or any, you know, legal judgment for that matter, since I think about law a lot. So for me, the integrative was one way of kind of focusing our attention on certain elements of those practical choices that get elided or written off in a lot of our intellectual labors. by deploying the term integrative, I am also, of course, trying to think about how we might better integrate our intellectual activities into our lived routines, and directing us to the day-to-day. You probably also have picked up on the extent to which the day-to-day is written off as some kind of debased sphere of intervention. There's an incredible utopian, future-oriented impulse and a lot of theory that any politics needs to be utopian in its fundamental ambitions. And I'm pretty skeptical of that, too. So it's an effort to, I think, looking at the integrative is an effort to counteract that impulse that shows up in a lot of places. That's cool. You're also wolf people. I didn't realize that Room of One's Own.
Yeah. I mean, I've taught a class on essayistic writing across texts and photo essay and video essay and film essay. And I always do a Room of One's Own. So I have like a really intimate relationship.
I've actually never taught it.
Oh God, it's so great. Yeah.
but I'm also, you know, in literary studies, right? You know, there are so many of these like canonical or widely celebrated texts that tend to be read in through a particular framework. That's why I'm so, even having written about Claudia Rankine's Citizen, I'm still kind of fixated on it because it, you know, on the one hand, rightly tends to elicit these interpretations that think about it as a meditation on structural oppression, right? And the tenacity of this kind of monolithic edifice of racism. And that's right, that's in there. It absolutely lends itself to those interpretations. But there are all of these other moments in the text that just get kind of neglected or overlooked that are actually gesturing towards something a lot more complicated, a lot more affirmative. And that's one of the reasons I'm also so interested in Wolf, right? Is she's, you know, often, you know, one of the, you know, the great spokesperson for a particular kind of queer consciousness. And that's true, that's there. But she's also doing this really normative project.
While being a radical critic of British Empire.
Yeah. And those two things can go hand in hand, right? And for, you know, all sorts of reasons, again, hence the book, we've just been utterly resistant to thinking about those things as going arm in arm or being part and parcel of the same intellectual fabric. And they can be, and they are, and they should be, and they need to be.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's like a certain kind of contemporary defeatist utopianism that I think you're speaking to, which is, you know, like, well, we must overcome capitalism, right? And if we don't overcome capitalism, which, by the way, on this show, we actually find the word capitalism to be highly reifying, but that's another conversation. But if we don't overcome capitalism...
The new like regular listener to
you're welcome to.
But yeah, sorry, let me cut you off. Yeah.
So if we don't fully overcome capitalism, then you know you can't ultimately have legitimate justice, right? One of the normative political projects that our heterodox world of econ and law and us humanities folks are committed to is a federal job guarantee, right? A right to work, right? This goes way back to Louis Blanc, you know, in the 19th century, throughout the, you know, the Reconstruction period, the Black struggle for freedom. There's a long, long tradition to point to, right? And, you know, there's a lot of other leftists we're in critical conversation with who will say, no, that, you know, that won't work under capitalism. Capitalism won't allow that to happen. And instead of, you know, our point is not to say, no, utopia is coming tomorrow, a right to work is arriving, you know, let's all start celebrating joyously that utopia is tomorrow. Nevertheless, we think there's a difference between standing by principles and critically evaluating the world with those normative claims on the table and in mind, and being put into the conversation as the values that we're weighing this reality against that I think we see in Wolf, and I also think that we see in your project.
Yeah, and just to kind of, you know, echo your observations about how the, you know, the insistence on that a revolutionary overthrow of capitalism is the only way to go, right? It also blinds us to some of these, you know, more complicated histories that exist within a particular intellectual formation. Like my most recent version of that is you know, 4 years ago, I started teaching 1L contract law, which is great fun. But had you talked to me before then or talked to any of my colleagues in the humanities, they would say, oh, contracts are, you know, tools of oppression. They're individualistic. They're at the root of capitalism. And so I'm teaching contract law and discover within that history that lo and behold, there have been, you know, all of these very progressive reforms, many of the efforts to codify and systematize contract law were informed by people influenced by German socialism. So that lo and behold, the sort of realist story of the evolution of contract law, especially in the early 20th century, is so much more complicated and nuanced and deeply collectivist and, you know, in a spirit we would actually want to get behind. So there's a way in which our, you know, this either or thinking leads to these blinkered responses that actually shut down or blind us to avenues for instituting change. I mean, I tend to be a bit more of a, you know, willing to accept incrementalist arguments for change too, but, you know, you don't want to tell anyone that.
Well, I think here we're open to increments and we're open to leaps and everything in between. I guess that's what I would say.
But I love your the account of capitalism, and yeah, I tend less to run in, you know, I tend to do less of the economic stuff and less to, you know, I'm less steeped in Marxist theory and those debates, right? Just because they sometimes tend to be more, I don't want to say inside baseball, but you know that, right? You know, and I don't know the baseball, but yeah, that we need to be coming up with viable approaches and strategies and solutions that don't depend on the end of capitalism or what have you.
There's one particular source that I think often gets read by our interlocutors as support for that idea that a job guarantee couldn't happen under capitalism because capitalism is a piece by Michel Kolesky called The Political Aspects of Unemployment, where he argues, basically he outlines, here are the reasons that capitalists will object to a full employment economy. Here are the reasons that they're going to do this. And he gives three, that the specifics don't matter so much as they take that as like supporting evidence that it will not work. I sort of understand it anyway as like, yeah, these are things to watch out for, right? As you
this
build.
Is why we fight,
right? This is why you fight and show up and like propose and repeatedly, you know, iterate and build upon experiments and positive affirmative projects. And what are you doing next? What are you, you mentioned a next project. Are you developing in that project some of the integrative criticism methodology, or yeah, what can you tell us?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still a little bit in between projects, but the one thing I'm have just started avidly working on is precisely to think about the propensity of some of these standard moves and standard left argumentative strategies, and frankly, ideological positions and critiques to be appropriated. So I'm increasingly haunted by how some of that reasoning is getting hijacked by more right-wing jurisprudence and in the court system. I mean, just to give a few examples, right, one of the things I track in my book is just how hardwired kind of a skepticism of law is among the left. Well, that kind of legal skepticism was a Breitbart platform. And so, you know, skepticism about incrementalist visions of law is becoming rampant among the new right. I'm very interested in how certain critiques of liberalism, for instance, that we've long thought of as kind of the bread and butter of more left progressive theory, are being arrogated among the left. I mean, I'm sorry, among the right, increasingly, and the right and the judiciary. So that kind of an anti-liberalism, and this isn't just in fringe circles, like Adrian Vermeule, I don't know if that's a name that rings a bell, has this blog called The Post-Liberal Order, and about a year ago published this book called Common Good Constitutionalism, which basically does Carl Schmitt in order to argue for kind of a return of vitalism to politics by way of a strong leader, right? So it's this weird apologetics for Trump. But this book is, he teaches at Harvard Law School. This book is getting taken seriously by all sorts of academics. It is leading to kind of positioning on the right as a result. But, if we had a half hour, I would catalog the number of sort of staples of theory that are alive and well and flourishing in the right. And I'm simply focusing on legal stuff as a discrete point of entry. But I'm trying to sort of prove the extent to which both our ideological positions and our critiques and our methodological tactics are all being actively hijacked in a lot of kind of these really recent, really controversial Supreme Court cases. You know, I am, it's precisely in that light. Like I'd finished the book well before the Dobbs decision was handed down. But that's for me exemplifies the ways in which a whole series of classically leftist moves are being deployed to justify, right, overturning the right to abortion. But there's a way in which that decision also gives me new fuel for thinking about the value of integrity as something we need to theorize in affirmative terms. Because when all of these kind of modes of critique are being deployed against us, you know, we the critics, how do we react to them? I'm not sure that throwing more indeterminacy into the mix is the answer. When somebody like Samuel Alito says, well, all legal rules are constructs, like we don't respond to that by evoking a constructivist thesis of truth, right? We need to have something that we can kind of independently build or build, take as a foundation. And, you know, I think integrity is one of those values that we maybe need to be, you know, adopting, endorsing, not without cognizance of the many dangers that would come with integrity. I mean, integrity carries with it all sorts of problematic associations I can enumerate, but nevertheless, thinking about the integrity of women's decision-making, women's bodily integrity, all of this stuff might be a helpful counterpoint to such a ruling.
I was just kind of free associating. I was thinking about if you've thought about these kind of spectacular melodramatic performances, you know, crying, breaking down on the witness stand that, you know, or, you know, before a panel, like by Kyle Rittenhouse or Brett Kavanaugh, right? The way that there's a kind of performance of trauma and victimhood on the right that may or may not be playing into the legibility that trauma studies has brought to bear. Not to blame trauma studies for those manipulations, but I'm curious if you've thought about that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I actually have one of my graduate students, Christina Fograssi, has this brilliant analysis of how the efforts to invalidate the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing actively kind of, you know, enlisted the conventions of trauma theory, but turned them on their head as this pretty savvy tactic for discrediting her testimony and undermining her authority as a witness. So trauma theory itself, right, is a sword that can be weaponized to poke holes in or discount particular manifestations of trauma. And her argument is that's exactly what happened. But yeah, and I think that would have to go hand in hand with the performance of traumatized male victim, which just shows to, you know, again, goes to show that, you know, all of these bequests of theory have been so valuable, but they've been too often presumed to equal a left progressive politics. And these are all examples of how that's, you know, that's just not true. They don't necessarily feed into a particular political position or agenda.
So not discrediting trauma theory, but more crediting or identifying the cynicism, opportunism, appropriation of trauma theory's strongest aspects by some of its worst opponents.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this has been a great discussion. Thank you so much, Elizabeth Anker, for joining us on Money on the Left.
Thank you again for having me. This has been so rewarding. I've learned new things about my book because of so many of your really brilliant interventions and spins on its argument. So I am hugely grateful for the chance to talk to the two of you. What do you mean? Walk past the people with their masks on. I know what's underneath. 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 Walking in a downpour, open the door, take me in, take me in. I see a window. I think you might just be that window. I see a little plant and slugs are having sex on it. The leaves are kinda shaking.